From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. When you think of an accessible space, you might picture a ramp to the side door of a building, big metal grab bars next to a toilet, or a button with a wheelchair insignia that automatically opens doors. But a concept called universal design is gaining traction. It's an idea that launched in the 1970s and was advocated for by Ronald L. Mace, an architect, product designer, and educator whose design philosophy was based on a more usable world. This was an evolution of the 1950s and 60s idea of access. Mace envisioned products and a built environment that would serve the needs of people who landed anywhere on the ability spectrum. There's a nonprofit organization named after him in Raleigh. Actually, I need to correct that. It's now based in Asheville, North Carolina, the R.L. Mace Universal Design Institute, which promotes the concept and practice of universal design. Richard Duncan is the Institute's founder and executive director, and he joins us today from member station WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. Richard Duncan, welcome to Coastline.
Hello, Rachel. Thanks.
Also with us today is Anne Glass. She's a professor in the School of Applied Human Health and Sciences at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She's also the coordinator of the gerontology program there. And her field of research, elder co-housing, is a relatively new area of study in the U.S. We'll learn more about that today. Anne Glass, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question for either of our experts on universal design, age-friendly spaces, accessibility, you can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Richard Duncan, give us a little history for this. When did Americans and the world start becoming aware of the need for accessible spaces?
Well, I guess in the United States in particular, unfortunately, it was as a result of the advances in battlefield medical technologies and the medical arts and sciences since then, when we had returning veterans from World War II and Korea that were fortunately surviving injuries that in prior wars they didn't survive. And this population of people was kind of the focus group for a couple of decades in figuring out how we could better accommodate them in their daily lives, in their homes, and in the buildings and places they needed to get to.
And how is the concept of accessibility different from the concept of universal design?
Well, you gave a good outline at the beginning of the show. It really is a design which is focused on people with disabilities, or perhaps you might say extreme human performance characteristics, to be a little bit more generic about it, which is to say people who you typically associate with using pieces of equipment like a power wheelchair or a motorized wheelchair, or even people who might be blind or people who might be deaf. And because so little had been done or even thought of in the decades prior to the 60s and 50s, and because the issues were so profound for these groups and being able to navigate and operate in the world, a lot of attention for many decades, quite rightfully, was paid to figuring out what could be done to design things differently, products and the built environment, architecture, for example. And that was quite useful and quite important and actually quite necessary. And that was the origins of kind of accessible design. Universal design was a concept that emerged from our experience in that area. It's a term that was first coined by our namesake, Ron Mace, back in the mid-80s when he was writing an article that mentioned this transcendent idea about design. And it came about partially with people seeing all of the broad beneficiary groups of what things that were supposed to be just for this narrowly framed group of people with disabilities. So, for example, you mentioned ramps at the beginning of the program. You know, ramps were required and are still step-free entrances into lots of buildings. What people began to notice is that, gee, it's not just folks who use wheelchairs who are using them. It's people with rolling luggage. It's the Coke delivery guy. It's the guy from FedEx who's bringing stuff in and out. All these groups, these unanticipated beneficiaries, kept cropping up for features like that and many others. So the idea was that maybe there's something to this. Maybe, in fact, there isn't this binary kind of design, special design that's accessible design over here and kind of normal design for everybody else over there. Maybe there's some more broad concept that can be derived and applied. So that's kind of how it came about. And that's, you know, broadly speaking, some of the differences between the approach to universal design, which is, you know, first of all, taking into account the whole wide range of users. And I'll say one more thing about that, Rachel, is that it's really important to be mindful of who you're designing for. And you're not designing for just this extreme group on one hand and an extreme group on another hand. That you have to realize that in all of our lives individually, we are a collection of very different kinds of human performance characteristics. You know, some of us are tall, some of us are short, some of us have stronger hands, some of us have hearing that's terrific, others not so good. And that changes with us in some cases daily, in some cases certainly over our lifetimes, and mapped out against society. It's a huge diversity of folks. And so it's that whole range of abilities and human performance characteristics that UD is trying to address.
And glass, we talk about age-friendly spaces. How is that different from the concept of universal design, or is it just a facet of it?
I would say that it overlaps the concept of universal design, and it does have in common with that the idea that you can make some of these accessibility changes and modifications that will help people of all ages, because it can also be somebody. You don't have to be an older person to have surgery and have to be in a wheelchair while you're recuperating. And you have people who have, you know, strollers and all of that with children. So the aging in place has become a really important concept, because when you do surveys with older people, 80 to 90% of them say they want to stay in the house where they're living right now. And they plan to continue to live there for another 10 years or more. And so the catch to that is that most of them do not think they need to do anything about their house. Maybe 20% out of that population would even have that on their radar at this point.
It's that small, yeah, in terms of recognizing that they need to make modifications,
exactly,
to be safe there.
Yes. And there's so much advantage to making the modifications, and especially if you can be proactive about it. And instead of being in denial, which a lot of us are in denial about getting older. And part of the problem, too, I think, is that we do have that perhaps you have from your childhood some image of ugly grab bars or something like that, and you don't want that in your house. But they're coming out with so many really nice designs now that can be incorporated in your bathroom and other spaces in your house that don't scream out, you know, that it's a home modification for accessibility, but it just looks like a nice design feature.
And Glass, tell us about some of the modifications that should be pretty common for people as they get older, some of the ways that their houses might start to become less safe.
Okay, well, there's a thing called a visitability initiative, first of all, and that actually focused on three main areas. And this, again, applies to really all ages, because you're going to have people coming and visiting. I had somebody in a wheelchair come to visit me, and to do the ideal with new housing as it's being built would be to have at least a main floor bathroom, ideally a bedroom and a full bath is what you really want as you're aging. Right, on the entry level. To have a no-step entry, and then to have wide doorways and hallways so you could maneuver a wheelchair if you needed to. And just that no-step entry alone, I just have been looking at houses. I just bought a house here in Wilmington since I just moved here last year. And it's surprising how hard it is to find a house with a no-step entry.
Richard Duncan, can you talk about, is there a divergence, first of all, between a building or an apartment building, let's say, or a house that's in compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA compliant, and a space that is actually functional for someone who might be in a wheelchair? Is there a divergence there? Is there a gap?
Probably. A fine point, Rachel. The ADA applies exclusively to the non-residential environment. And when you get into residential environments, the only place you've got any kind of broad strokes requirements for increased usability is from a different set of federal civil rights pieces of legislation called the Fair Housing Amendments Act. You know, one of the differences, but so that's just to draw that distinction.
Sure.
But to answer your question, one of the differences in a kind of a UD approach is that you have to include elements of utility, increased functionality in the environment or in the home in this case. But it's also got to meet another very important test, which is the fact that you'd have to have the design features integrated into the overall design of the house in a way that makes the home marketable to a broad audience. And that's one of the distinguishing features of UD from accessibility. Accessibility doesn't kind of have that burden. It doesn't require that you have something that's usable and desirable by a large number of people. It has to be as functional. So that's the distinction between, let's say, a ramp up to a house versus a graded step-free entrance that may go from the driveway up to the front door or the back door. You know, one is usually something that's added on that may be taken away as soon as the owner or occupant leaves. The other is something that's permanent, elegant, looks good, and works well.
It's part of the aesthetic of the structure.
One would hope. That would be the ideal, yeah, exactly.
And when you're talking about just accessibility, then you're talking about just things that might have been pasted on, in a sense, to been part of a later modification.
In some cases, Anne was referring to kind of home access modifications, and very often people are kind of boxed in if they're not thinking in advance, and they have to do these kind of late in life changes that they're not planning for.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring the concept of universal design with two experts today, and we're exploring how to create an environment that works for people of all ages and levels of ability. You can ask your own question of Richard Duncan and Professor Anne Glass on this Wednesday. The phone lines are now open. Give us a call, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We'll be back in 90 seconds. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about universal design and aging in place. With us today are two experts. Professor Anne Glass studies elder co-housing and is the coordinator of the gerontology program at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Richard Duncan is the executive director of the North Carolina-based nonprofit R.L. Mace Universal Design Institute, which advocates for broader use of universal design. He joins us today from the studios of Member State Station WCQS in Asheville. And our guests are taking your questions today. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org if you have a question about aging in place, modifying a structure, or building a structure that incorporates the concept of universal design. We've been talking kind of broadly about what this is, but I want to get to this issue of ageism, Anne Glass. It's your contention that the existence of ageism has something to do with our reluctance to make modifications that we should be making or to start incorporating elements of universal design. Can you, first of all, what is ageism? What does that mean?
Well, ageism is like any other ism, sexism, racism, where you are putting negative stereotypes against a group. But it's unlike that kind, either of those, because ageism actually is something we are all going to get old if we're lucky. So if you are ageist, if you dislike older people or you dislike aging, then in a sense you're ultimately going to dislike yourself because, you know, it's going to apply to all of us. And unfortunately, in our country, this is very much part of our culture. It's
How do we see it evidenced in our culture?
Well, there's very much an association of youth equals beauty. So every advertisement you see, and in fact, I was just looking at Barnes & Noble, the bookstore the other day, to see what kind of books they had on aging. And at least 75, 80% or more of the books were really about anti-aging or what you can do to stay young or how to stay young forever or live forever, instead of really helping people accept the fact that we are aging, which I believe is the way to go, and try to make it the best you can be. But in our society, there are just so many, you know, the birthday cards and the TV shows and the way aging is portrayed is just often very negative. And there, you know, there are many examples of it on the web too, YouTube videos and so forth. So if we can get, if we can begin to get people to accept the fact that they're aging and talk more about it, there are many gifts in aging too. And I came to realize when I was doing my research that we really don't give older people an opportunity to talk about what it feels like to get older, you know, which is kind of a basic thing. I call it aging literacy. But we don't, if there's an event for older people, it's usually an expo where we're trying to sell them services because we think they need something. But really, most older people are in good health and many are having the best years of their lives. So I think we need to, as a society, start to change our views about what it's like to get older.
How can we do that?
Well, talking more about it and having programs like this is a good opportunity. I think in this case, aging in place and starting to do things to your home so you can be more comfortable as you get older and you can stay there longer and you can be independent longer. If we talk more about that, it starts to normalize that. And so more people are saying, yeah, my friends are doing that. I'm going to do that too. And we should start thinking about that. And there are opportunities in, I think about it with shows like House Hunters International, you know, and or the local national version. They're missing opportunities to have people talk about those things when they look at houses, when they're retired and that kind of thing.
So, Ann Glass, if I were going to get a basic checklist from you on the things that I need to look at in my home so that it can accommodate a person of any age and any ability, what would some of those big things be that I need to start looking at?
Okay, well, as I mentioned before, having the 8-bedroom and a full bath on the main floor, the entry floor, the no-step entry, no steps between rooms, because that's a fall hazard right there, and again, would limit you with if you needed a wheelchair, that kind of thing. The bathroom modifications, the grab bars, getting in and out of a bathtub can get tricky because you have to climb over the wall and they're slippery when you're standing up. So having grab bars around the bathtub in particular and maybe the toilet would be very helpful. Something as simple as more lighting. This is something people don't even think about, but as you get older, you need more light, maybe 3 times as much light.
3 times as much light.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a simple and fairly, you know, that's fairly inexpensive to put more lights and better light bulbs and so forth. Having railings, if you have stairways, having railings on both sides of the steps is a good idea.
And Richard Duncan, if I could get you to weigh in on this. So So we have these ideas of modifications that can be made. How can some of these modifications be made, or how can a home be built that incorporates this kind of idea without screaming, I'm here for an older person? Although, according to Ann Glass, we should start to accept that. But let's say we're not there yet. We still want our home to look beautiful and look like it could accommodate anybody.
There's a certain amount of both of those things happening. There are some pieces of assistive technology that it's hard to avoid at some point, but certainly up to that point, you can do a lot better job. And earlier, I didn't want to kind of dismiss accessibility features in homes as being either unneeded or impossible to make look good, because you can have actually very nice-looking accessibility features if you needed those things. So it isn't all that everything you might do has to be looking ugly. You can have a nice-looking ramp, for example, but it just tends not to be as permanent. So things you can do include just basic kinds of home features. We talked, and I think Ann has mentioned, and we may mentioned before, the step-free entrance. So you've got to have that as an element in your house. Doesn't have to be even into the front door, though. A lot of people think you have to have an entrance in the front door, and then you're going to eliminate that nice kind of elevation with the stairs going up to the front porch. It's fine. You can go in through the garage. In fact, that's where 99% of us go into the house from, if we have an attached garage or a carport, or even through another entrance in the house. When you're talking about single-family detached housing, we tend to be fairly forgiving of a lot of different entry options because it's so challenging. And as far as bathrooms are concerned, that's an area where, you know, you do add a lot of hardware. if you need some assistance, and you can do a lot short of doing that. You can have a very wonderful, in fact, it's the room in the house you can set up at the front end and really not change very much all the way through your lifespan, because you've done things like you put blocking in the walls near the toilet, near the shower, and the tub, so you can add a grab bar later on if you need to, and most importantly, where you need to. It's not the kind of places you see in your hotel room, for example, necessarily. Everyone has kind of a different performance characteristic, and they need a grab bar at a different location. Beyond that, you can actually have things that are kind of morphed grab bars these days that we call handholds or securement points that are terrific ideas that add utility and also some aesthetics. So you can get a handhold that's built into your toilet paper dispenser next to your toilet, because a lot of us need a little bit of assistance getting up and down. You don't want to have one of these grab bars. You can use one of these things that looks like it's supposed to be there. You can have a little soap dish installed in your shower or tub. Same idea, a little elegant little bar in the front that you can use that a lot of us every day, certainly me in my shower, could use a little helping hand to just put your hand there to balance yourself as you're coming or going. And great looking towel bars now that double as grab bars. So the aesthetics has really gone way up, and you don't really have to have the same stereotypical look to things. You don't have to have anything at all because you have the blocking in the walls behind there.
And glass. You wanted to make a comment, and then I have a question.
I did, and Richard might want to speak to this a little more, too, when we're talking about putting in grab bars and such. One thing we should caution the listener is that there are some grab bars available that just kind of use suction cups, and people put those on the wall.
The cheap version that don't require support inside the wall.
And that is dangerous, I think Richard would concur with that. And in a way, it's even more dangerous because people think it's going to hold their weight and that, you know, they've got it taken care of. But yet those pull off the wall very easily sometimes. So just
it's an intriguing product, an intriguing technology that I don't have the data on it, but it certainly does seem as if there's lots of potential for it not being, you know, suctioned on correctly and it would come off at just the wrong moment.
Right. I think there's some that I've seen a model recently that has suction cups that are, I don't know what the diameter is, but it has to be mounted on a tile that's 4 inches and square.
Yeah.
It has to be completely sealed. And if it's not, and many bathrooms are not designed that way, then, you know, you think you've got it and you don't.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about adjusting to our built environment to the needs of a broader range of people, ideally according to the universal design concept, in a way that accommodates people of all ages and abilities. Our guest today, Professor Anne Glass of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is the gerontology program coordinator there, and she studies elder co-housing, a relatively new field of study in the U.S. Richard Duncan is also with us from WCQS in Asheville. He is Executive Director of the R.L. Mace Universal Design Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing awareness and practice of universal design. You can ask your own question of our experts on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also call us today at 910-343-1138. Anne Glass, what is the line between counseling people to stay active and counseling people to recognize when they start to have limitations? We talked about the toilet situation, and Richard Duncan talked about possibly a support near the toilet roll holder. And, you know, the fitness trainer in me, which I'm not, to be clear, wants to say, right, sink your heels into the floor and use those quadriceps and rock back and forth and push yourself up and keep those leg muscles toned. How do you balance that?
Well, that's a good question, because the example being the stairs, and, you know, many people have stairs in their home and they have to go up the stairs to get to their bedroom, and that is good. I mean, you know, it is good to be active and to keep moving, and that's one of the best things you can do, actually. It's very important in terms of fall prevention as well, which maybe we can talk about that too.
Yes.
Because a lot of these changes that we're talking about making in your house are with an eye towards preventing falls, which is essential for older people. In fact, while I'm on that topic, I'll just might point out that every second an older adult falls in the United States.
Just in the United States,
yeah.
Every second.
Every second. So and while we're talking.
And what does that mean? Explain to us what the risk is there, why fall prevention is so important.
Well, as we get older, and especially as we get into the 80s and beyond, we become a little more unstable, a little more frail perhaps. We might have vision problems. We might be taking medications that affect our balance. So there are all kinds of things that can affect us. And if you're not making a point of staying physically active, one of the worst things, in fact, that can happen is that you get a fear of falling. And that keeps you from moving. You know, you just sit down, you don't go places, and that actually puts you at more risk because then your muscles tend to weaken and so forth, and you're actually more likely to fall.
And a fall is much more dangerous for an older person.
Absolutely.
Than a younger person. Why?
Because of the health conditions that they may be having, the bones may be more brittle. Someone with a hip fracture, for example, that often starts them in a downward spiral. So if we can prevent that at all costs, that would be important. And actually, I think the figure is 74 people die every day, older people die every day because of the results of injuries from a fall. So if nothing else, that should help spur people to make some of these changes so their homes are safer.
I don't want to go too far down that medical rabbit hole, but that's something we hear all the time. Well, she fell and she broke her hip, and then it wasn't long after that she passed away. Why is that? What's the link?
Well, the hip fracture in particular is very dangerous for older people because it tends to make, they have to stay in bed while they're healing. And the longer you're in bed, that does things to your body that are not good.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about universal design and age-friendly spaces. We have Professor Anne Glass from UNCW. She is the gerontology program coordinator there. We also have Richard Duncan from member station WCQS in Asheville, North Carolina. He's the executive director of the R.L. Mace Universal Design Institute. You can ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Michael from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was just wondering if the panel would touch a little more on how new and emerging technologies might affect universal inclusivity in the near future.
That's a great question. Thank you, Michael. Richard Duncan, would you like to tackle that first?
Well, I'm sure that he has something particular in mind, but we look at it a lot now in the housing area. We know that having a well-designed house is the starting point for this, and we see all the rapidly emerging home technologies as being terrific additions that both add convenience and ease of use, and frankly, in some cases, a little bling, let's be honest, as well as some real functionality for safety and security and independence, particularly as we grow older. So it does a lot of different things. And that certainly is one area that we see technology having a real positive impact in this whole area.
Anne Glass.
I would just add to that since we were just talking about fall prevention, that's an area where technology can be built into the home. There are ways to have the floors built so that they can monitor if someone falls, for example.
The floor, it's a smart floor and can tell. Explain how that would work.
Well, Richard maybe can explain it better. I don't know the whole technology, but I know that they, for example, if you have an older relative who's living alone and you're the daughter, let's say, and you kind of want to keep an eye or know that they're safe, that's one of the ways that it can be done.
Yeah, there's a lot of motion sensing technologies that can, again, particularly for the frail elderly person who isn't able to have a family member with them all the time or a caregiver, where they can monitor either your movement or your activities. So are you eating food regularly? They can monitor things like that. And I think that's a great help in keeping people home on the one hand and safe because they're monitored a little bit. There's a privacy issue there, we know. But it also enables family members or others, it could be others that you designate, to make sure that assistance can come and can be available quickly.
And we also hear about some older people getting confused about medications and either overdosing on them or forgetting to take them. Is there technology that can help with that? Anne Glass?
Yes, there absolutely is. There are I mean, on the very simple level, just using the boxes where you have the pills laid out every day of the week or every time, you know, morning, noon, and night can be a very good help to a lot of people. But then beyond that, they now have medicine dispensers that you can have in your home that have a sound associated with them to tell people, to remind them that it's time to take their medication.
And we have Bill from Bolivia. Welcome to Coastline, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the universal design home. I'm thinking about building a home. I'm getting up in age, my wife and I, and we want to stay in place. What does that add to the square footage cost, or is it, I know that's kind of a loose term, but if you could help me with that, that would be great. On about a 2,600 square foot house.
That's a great question. Thanks. And we'll let Richard Duncan tackle that. Is it? Is this an expensive?
$148.50. That's the answer.
That's a joke, right?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, good.
I'm sorry. Ask your question, Major.
In all seriousness, how much expense does this add to the design of a house if you start from scratch and build the house with some of these features in there?
Yeah, it's a common question too, and I have a crappy answer for your caller, and that, which is that it depends. If the 2,600 square foot house you're starting from, maybe you have a plan in mind, is one that's particularly awkward to change and to modify it to a kind of a UD standard, then you may find it boosting the cost from what it might have otherwise cost to build a standard house. You can build one-story homes of that square footage. You can build, and even from a UD perspective, two-story homes. We don't mind. You can have the second or third bedroom upstairs or the office upstairs, as long as your primary function areas are on this reachable level. I'll mention two
Richard,
things.
Richard, hang on 1 second.
Yes,
we're going to go to break in a second, and so I'm going to let you finish that answer when we come back. Bill, thanks so much for that call. You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of universal design with a focus on the built environment, creating spaces for people of all physical abilities and ages. When we come back from this 90-second break, you'll have one more segment to ask your question. The number is 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org, and we're going to answer a question from Don when we come back. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're learning about universal design and setting up spaces for people of all ages and abilities. With us to answer your questions on this Wednesday, Richard Duncan, Executive Director and founder of the R.L. Mace Universal Design Institute, a North Carolina nonprofit dedicated to advancing the use of universal design. He's joining us today from WCQS in Asheville. And Professor Anne Glass, coordinator of UNCW's Gerontology Program. She's also a researcher in the relatively new field of elder co-housing. You have a few minutes left to ask your question or offer your comment. You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Richard Duncan, just before we went to break, you were answering Bill's question, Bill from Bolivia, who wanted to know, he's thinking about building a house that incorporates some of these principles that would make a house age-friendly for him as he and his wife get into their later years. And he was asking about the kind of cost this might add.
Yeah, great. So two areas to look at. One is, and it may be more design and engineering than actual construction cost, is figuring this step-free entrance, whether it's through the front, whether it's graded that way, whether you can do it through an attached garage or a carport or something else. That tends to be a design challenge. Might be some extra cost, might not be. But the biggest area inside the home is, believe it or not, in product selection. You can really break your budget if you go for the whole array of more ergonomically and accommodating product selections. For example, if you went for the front-loading, front-control clothes washer and dryer, more expensive than your standard top load. If you went for a kitchen design that included a stovetop and a separated wall oven, much more ergonomic in many cases, but that's a more expensive choice than a floor-standing range. If you did include and decided to, and I would advise this, if at all possible, a curbless shower, at least in one of your full bathrooms in the house, that may cost extra. It's a terrific thing. That's one of the things I would think be most cost-effective about this. And we can go on. You can have side-hinged crank windows, which are a more expensive price point than standard single or double-hung windows, and on and on. So you can have a really terrific, universally designed home without using any of those products. But if you add those more convenient features in there, then the price can climb.
Mm-hmm. And glass. You have some information about assistance in terms of home modification. There is actually something available from Medicaid for people.
Right. And I think cost is one of the issues that keeps people from making these kind of modifications. And in addition to denial about aging, there is some assistance available in the state of North Carolina through the Community Alternative Program for Disabled Adults. And that's a Medicaid home and community-based services waiver. That's the good news. The bad news is that there's a waiting list for that assistance. And there, in some states, there's another program, but only a third of the states in this country have it. And unfortunately, North Carolina is not one. That's a state assistance program for home modifications for aging in place. That's the title of it. It's specifically for this purpose, but we don't have that here. But we do have the Community Alternative Program. And a good place to start, this is associated with lower income to meet Medicaid qualifications, but a place for anybody to start would be to call the local area agency on aging, which here in the New Hanover and Brunswick County and the surrounding counties is the Cape Fear Council of Governments. And I do have a phone number. The local number is 910-395-4553. And they have a toll-free number of 800-218-6575. And they would be probably a good place to start in terms of finding out if there are any resources available.
And we will, of course, put all of that information on our website so people can find it easily after this broadcast. Richard Duncan, I want to go back for a second. Earlier in this discussion, I asked you about a potential divergence between ADA compliant and a space being truly usable by someone who has a disability or is in a wheelchair. And the reason I ask that, and of course you explained the distinction between ADA compliant, which doesn't usually apply to residential spaces, and the Fair Housing Act. Are there regulations in place that put the responsibility for subsidized public housing designers and developers to ensure that the design and construction will accommodate the challenges of the diversity of tenants, especially the aged and disabled, who cannot be refused public housing in that regard?
The short answer is yes. Whether it's public housing or other forms of subsidized housing, let's say housing that's maybe funded or underwritten by the State Housing Finance Agency, you know, if the funds come from an agency like that, sometimes it's channeled from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, and usually there are additional requirements for either more accessible units, if it's multifamily apartment buildings, or more levels of accessibility that actually accommodate people with sensory impairments, like vision and hearing problems as well. I don't know that it probably goes far enough these days. I think with our demographic changes and with people needing to be aging in places that are safe, a lot of the standard units that they might be making that are still most of what's being put up there may require some expensive changes. So, yeah, I guess that would be an area that we'd like to see even more attention paid to this whole area of making them more accommodating for people's lifespans.
And we have an email from Johanna. She says, I work at the outpatient therapy clinic at the Davis community in town. Want to remind listeners, occupational therapists specialize in recommendations for home modification for those with limitations. Of course, at Davis, we focus on fall prevention in older adults, but all OTs, occupational therapists, can make recommendations for those with other problems. Thank you for that email, Johanna. And we have a number of callers on the line. Ann Glass, did you want to make a quick point?
I did, since we brought up about the OT and their role. There's also something called a certified aging in place specialist, and those are often home builders who have had extra training in this particular field and are better equipped perhaps to come in and analyze what might be done to help you if you want to make changes in your existing home.
And we have Len from Southport. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes, I recently made modifications to a custom home in Southport, North Carolina, and with little to no additional cost because of the size of the house it was, but incorporating wider hallways, wider doorways so that you can turn hospital beds, putting in stairs that had very low risers with big treads on them, well-lit, well-defined edges, lowering the light switches and raising the outlets, made all of those, incorporated all those things for little to no cost.
So, Len, you're one of maybe 20%, maybe less, of the population, according to Ann Glass's statistics, who do this. Is this because you have a need for this right now, or are you planning ahead?
We were planning ahead. We were looking at models in Virginia and saw the universal design concepts in a model and tried to incorporate as many as we could when we got to North Carolina for retirement. But, yeah, I mean, the size of the house, it matters, because you have to have enough room to make the hallways wider without impacting the sizes of the rooms. So I think for a spec house, it'd be more difficult, more costly.
Len, thank you so much for that call. And we have Mary from Leland. Mary, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm in a wheelchair, and when I first moved down here, I had a home that I modified from the beginning. And one of the things that I did, I had a grate put in front of the door. It's like a pipe that drains out past the porch into the mulch. And that's a way to get around having a flush doorway. A lot of builders won't do that because then they can't put the house under warranty for flooding. But if you have grating right in front of your doorway, the water doesn't get in, and that was that didn't cost hardly anything extra. 3-foot doorways are always a good idea for bathrooms, any bathroom. And also, doorways that, instead of having a single door, have like the door split, so when you pull it out, it's easier to open a split door where you just, you know, in other words, it's, I think, 18 inches on each side. When you're in a wheelchair, trying to open and close a door that's 3 feet wide is cumbersome, but when the door is split in half, it makes it a lot easier. And I think also pocket doors are really great. Builders will sometimes complain because they have to rewire the house then, like, you know, move their wiring around a little on that wall. But pocket doors are just so easy to work with, they don't take up any extra space. So if you can't have a wider hallway, a pocket door is an answer because the door doesn't open way out into the hallway because it's in the wall.
That's very helpful. Mary, thank you so much for that call. Richard Duncan, what is a pocket door?
I want to congratulate your listeners, Rachel. These are some great points. A pocket door is a door that slides back into a wall cavity rather than being hinged and swinging either into a room or out into a larger space. And so, as your caller was saying, you avoid that door swing. You have to work around whether you use a wheelchair or a walker if you're just walking around.
And Richard Duncan, a lot of the advocacy work that you do for universal design is in the area of housing. Do you run into obstacles with builders and developers who aren't interested in incorporating these features? And if so, what are those obstacles?
Well, that's also a good question. We've been talking to the industry for many decades now, and in some senses, I'd say, frankly, that the industry is probably better poised to do stuff than consumers are to ask for it. Consumers seem to be the big lagging indicator, as we've been talking about all program long, is that insufficient numbers of people in enough places, enough times, are voting with their dollars to go for, you know, builder A versus builder B, and the builders aren't seeing them lose any market share or any house sales or remodeling jobs to the other guy because he's offering a superior product. So programs like this, I hope, will help that in the Wilmington area and every place else where people are listening, you can vote with your dollars and know that you can actually make suggestions that people can actually act on to give you a better house.
Anne Glass.
Yes, I would agree with what Richard was saying. And again, since I was recently in the house hunting market here in Wilmington, and I have also heard from other people in the area who have been looking for homes, I think that it really does need to be the consumers pushing for more of this to be incorporated in their housing. The builders are not going to do it if you're not asking for it. And that's one fact. But I also looked at a recent study. This is just from 2015, 2016, and they are finding that accessibility issues are becoming a key concern. They are rising to the top as far as issues that people are starting to ask for with their architects and in the design of homes. So among the top six most active included the first floor master, the ramps and elevators, on-grade entry, and easy-to-use features.
Can we go back for a second? Because what you're talking about is a demographic that has access to resources, money, people who can afford to build their own homes. When you're looking at, say, a lower cost apartment building, you don't own that, you don't have that kind of leverage. There are what are called accessible apartment spaces here. And some of us who work here at WHQR know someone who was looking around for a space and went in and found, while this was, you know, it was identified as accessible, meaning there were wider doors, there were other features in the apartment that made it not really livable for this person. Is that a common issue, Anne Glass?
Well, I will give an example that I ran into. I was staying in an apartment that was part of a friend's home, and it really struck me because I think it had been outfitted to be like for the mother-in-law or something of a previous owner, and they had gone to the trouble of actually putting in a pull cord in the bathroom so that she could call for help if she fell, if she could reach it. That's another story. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they got to that trouble, so they put some thought into it, and yet the door to the bathroom was very narrow. I mean, you know, less than average in width. And so that just was a real puzzle to me because it's obviously they put thought into it, but they didn't think it all out. So these are the kind of things you really need to think through when you're looking at homes. I mean, it can be buying an existing home too. And one of the things that the building industry does say is that home builders are beginning to respond to this. And so with the newer houses that are coming along, they are more likely to have some of these features, and certainly some of the things like the walk-in shower and such is becoming more common. But that's also a mismatch in our country because most of the new housing, three-quarters of it, is being built in the South and the West, but the older people are dispersed across the country.
And very briefly, Anne Glass, what is elder co-housing?
Well, elder co-housing, the model of co-housing is quite prevalent in some of the countries in Europe, Denmark and Netherlands, for example. And it came over an intergenerational model a few decades ago. But just 10 years ago, we started with older adult only. And the idea is that you would have maybe 25 to 30 people. You each have your own home, but they surround a common space and there's a common house. You would get together a couple times a week and have a meal together. They run it themselves, which makes it unlike any other senior living kind of option. And you would immediately know your neighbors. So unlike living in the suburbs, which are not a great place to age in place, by the way, where you can drive in your garage and you wouldn't even know who lives next door to you, this is a place where within 24 hours you would probably know everybody, and you would have people you could call on, and you would have people that can help you when you come home from the hospital, things like that.
Richard Duncan, briefly, if there was one thing that you could get people to remember from this conversation, what would it be, very briefly?
I guess it would be to plan ahead and not wait until something bad happens. Know that you can do something good-looking and probably cost-effective long before you would actually need to use it full-time in a big way.
That's this edition of Coastline. Richard Duncan, Anne Glass, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. And join us for Thursday's Coastline when we explore how special education is evolving. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.